gorgeous Hans. We are back. I'm back from my holiday. We're fresh off the back of our double parter on the Big Kids Question, and it has been a time, has it not?
Seems to have gone down well.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever loved doing the podcast so much as in these past few weeks.
I so agree with
you. We have been blown away by your DMs, by your emails, your messages, your thoughts. Like, we knew when we decided to do this episode that we were probably tapping into something that was relevant to people other than just the two of us. We felt like if this is such a huge topic for us, surely it must be for others. And I think the feedback has been true testament to that.
Yeah, I think what's been so lovely about these messages is a lot of the women have said, oh, I thought I was the only one who thought that, or I've never been able to say that to even my close friends.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to have this conversation specifically because we'd found it so interesting having it with one another. But my big thing is that I've always wanted to have these conversations with other people, but it's so personal and you are so aware that you might be stepping on someone's toes, that actually to be able to find a sense of togetherness with our honeys, who lots of them we've never even met in person, and you can have these like intimate conversations and tell each other things that we might not be telling our own best friends.
It's so special
and it's like been such a game changer. I just love it.
So with that in mind, I want to read out an amazing email we got from one listener who is 28 years old. She says she's from a traditionally working class northern city, and within my small friendship group, three of my friends have two kids each, the first being when they were 22 and 23. And this is extremely common where I'm from. Most girls I went to school with are all mums now. From my core friendship group, I am the only one who went to university, and none of them are particularly immersed in pop culture media, which I also think makes a big difference. Like you mentioned, circumstances are a huge factor. I've been in my relationship since I was 18, the longest out of my friends. However, both of our parents were in their late 30s when they had us, so to us, our 20s were never going to be the age we were going to have children. He is also university educated and follows the media, etc. Friends of mine who have been to university and then followed a career path from their degree are also the very few who don't yet have children. And because my friends had children at such a young age, this did change our friendship. We weren't yet old enough to have been going out to nice lunches and dinner dates or cute little holidays. We were still at the getting rotten in the local pub every weekend stage when suddenly they were parents and couldn't. This ultimately changed my relationship with my partner too. I couldn't do as much with my friends, so I do everything with him. We go to gigs, festivals, city breaks, travel the world, spend lots of money in restaurants and nice bars, as well as things for our home, making the things we'd have to cut back on if we were to have children so much higher, and changing the nature of our relationship. I've always thought I'd be a mum. I played dolls as a child. I had baby names picked out since I was 18, and I especially wanted to have children with my partner. I just knew it would be once I was 30 plus. However, I found as this inches closer and I've watched my friends become parents and the state of the world, quite frankly, get almost inhabitable, I found I'm looking at reasons not to more and telling myself I'd be content with my partner and some little dogs. A big part of this as well is that in the last 5 years, my partner has lost both his parents. Though hard to explain why, we've both said that this has changed our perspective and made us think harder about our decision when and if it ultimately becomes time.
I absolutely love that perspective. Thank you, honey, if you're listening, so much for sending that in. Because I think what's really fascinating about it is that it speaks to the grey area that we so want to explore. You know, having kids is often posited as like, you either do or you don't. It's an intuition that you have. You'll know for sure what's right for you. And actually, I think what we've been saying and what clearly so many other Huns are feeling is that it's totally dependent on so many factors, all the way from like societal structural ones to like your own mood that day.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Or something as unexpected as she says, a parent dying or someone, maybe a relative getting really ill, and maybe you just decide you want to have kids whilst they're still alive so that they can meet them. You know, there's so many things we can't predict.
Yeah. As we've said just before you reading this out, I think what's lovely about us all being able to share here is you can do it without any sense of feeling that you're casting judgment on others.
Exactly.
You can just say what your experience is and how you feel about it. And that's not reflective of anyone else's decisions. Whereas I think when you're at the pub with like IRL friends, you can have to tread really carefully.
I actually loved the message we got from one hun saying that we'd made her feel more positive about having kids.
I know, because we didn't want it to be like Debbie Downer,
yeah.
Did we? And we certainly didn't want anyone that already has children to listen and feel like bad about themselves at all. We had one listener who said, her DM said that Ellie, this is Kathleen speaking, that Ellie perfectly articulated her thoughts and she's currently pregnant. And the way that you sort of rounded it all up was bang on for how she felt prior.
I'm so glad.
There was one message that I found really interesting as well, actually, beyond kind of personal circumstances like we've touched on, that speaks to the broader societal forces at play. And it was from a lovely hun called Darina, who very kindly DM'd. I want to read it to you.
Yes, babe. Give it to me.
So she writes that she wanted to share some of her thoughts. It really resonated with me when you mentioned how choosing motherhood over career can often be frowned upon, looked down on, and how you could be told that you are not living up to your best potential if you choose the full-time mum path. Even worse, I often get this from feminist voices. As a woman from Eastern Europe, I've often find myself infantilised in conversations about feminism and given a stigma that I would only pick a domestic role because I'm not given an alternative. Well, that is not true at all. I agree with you, Anne Gabor Mate, that raising and nurturing children is the most important thing we could do as a society, but I'd like to take this a step further. My problem with the whole career over motherhood being the option when you find success and self-realise is that it's incredibly patriarchal and neoliberal, because ultimately your contribution to society is measured at a higher value if that contribution serves capitalism and grows GDP. Because we live in an economy that is designed for endless growth, if your work doesn't yield a product that can feed the machine, it's not good enough. But if we would live in a society that values domestic work and care work the same way it values traditional jobs, if we would centre everything around people's well-being, then this argument couldn't have been made.
Fantastic point.
Isn't it? And I loved it because I think it really follows on from what we spoke about in the first episode, which is that for a lot of people right now, having children has become like a lifestyle choice that is dictated by their financial circumstances. I think it's Pregnant Then Screwed said that the reason that they think the ONS data is showing that fertility is at an all-time low is because it's like a kind of privilege and a luxury to be able to afford children. And so I love Darina's message about actually how we devalue parenting as a whole within the framework of like laissez-faire, you know, late stage capitalism, because it speaks to why people aren't having kids rather than an innate desire to be child free. It's that society's circumstances are not enabling these choices.
And recording the podcast has encouraged me to have more conversations with my male friends. In fact, I've spoken to two guys in the last 2 weeks who both said that they think having children is the most important thing that we can do societally, and that they felt that it was literally the meaning of life, which is interesting because I feel like actually in my female friendships, I don't think women would say that so brazenly, because I think we are so cautious of not reducing ourselves in that way, whereas men I guess are more like, no, that is genuinely the meaning of life. But maybe that's problematic, I don't know. It's quite interesting.
That is interesting, and actually that is making me think of our poll and how many of the listeners that responded were actually still undecided about having children. It was 47%, I believe, were still on the fence. And I've noticed, again, like anecdotally, it's much more often the woman that's grappling in heterosexual relationships. It's the woman that's grappling with the kids question more than it is the man. But I was saying to my partner when we were discussing this the other day, that I think that's just because literally women have to give up more. They have to give up their bodies, their careers, like all the things that we've covered and I won't go into now. But I would ask those men, who I do not disagree with by any stretch, but what are they doing that is encouraging a societal infrastructure that is going to enable us to take on child rearing as a priority?
Exactly.
Prove you're really in it to save the human race.
Exactly, guys. Give us a business plan. Also, I feel like I don't know any men who don't want... Isn't it weird? I've just thought about this right now. I don't know any men who have said, I don't want children. They've all said, yes, absolutely. Because it's so easy for them to say that.
Yeah. And even in Olive, Emma Gannon's novel, the conceit is that Olive has been in a 10-year plus relationship with her partner, and she has to end it because it's her that doesn't want kids, not him.
Because men don't lose anything really by having kids, do they?
Yeah, and this is what I was trying to explain to my partner. I was saying it's a much bigger life decision, because your life fundamentally changes as a woman in a way that it doesn't if you're a man, particularly if you have conventional jobs and you do like 2 weeks of paternity leave and then you're back in the office. Well, your life hasn't actually tangibly changed that much if you go back to the life you had before. Again, air quotes here. I mean, of course, your whole like perspective and everything changes. Like we said, it's not to undermine the kind of transformative nature of parenthood for men too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, as we said, guys, we did promise to keep the conversation going. So in that spirit, we will continue with any fascinating perspectives. DMs, please keep them coming. We love, love, love hearing from you, in case we haven't made that clear enough.
Yes, Straight Up Pod on Instagram, or you can email us at hello@straightuppodcast.co.uk. Okay, Cathers, on with the rest of the episode. I think we must talk about Kate Middleton.
So guys, I'm sure you are already well aware, but in case you don't know, you are listening to Straight Up, the pop culture podcast hosted by us journalists and besties, Kathleen and Ellie.
It's us.
We are looking at a whole mix of things today. I won't say smorgasbord because I know that was on the banned list of words from several months ago.
You haven't said it in a few weeks, but...
Months, I would say, thank you. I've tried my best.
Meanwhile, I'm trying not to say absolutely at everything.
I will hold you to that.
Yeah.
We did have a bit of an interesting...
Oh, God, we just...
...phase, but we will not be... We've probably just said interesting 8,000 times.
We did. We both said interesting about 5 minutes ago.
So sorry, guys, allow us on the interestings, and we will try to not draw your attention to any of our little foibles moving forward. Kate Middleton.
So, guys, we're going to focus on the media angle. I think, you know, it goes without saying that this is a very sad situation, and I can't imagine how her and her family must feel. And I am kind of in shock that there are still so many trolls on the internet, like, still peddling these conspiracy theories.
Are there?
Yeah.
God, I haven't even seen that.
Yeah.
So they're saying that it's...
They're saying that they must be hiding something else because... it's still so weird how the palace handled it. It's like, no, I think the palace just are really bad at handling comms.
They just really need a drastic update on the comms front, don't they?
Which might be why they're hiring a new comms assistant.
Oh, are they? Well, yeah. There we go.
If you want to apply, guys, I think it's like £12 an hour or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to know. And again, I really don't want to like dive into all the conspiracies and make light of what is actually an incredibly like upsetting situation. But was that her that wrote the small statement about the photo editing? Because that does still seem odd.
I reckon maybe the palace wrote that and asked for her approval and then, yeah, tweeted it out. I mean, I never think that they... I guess they never really write their own messages on there anyway. But I would assume she was maybe advised that that would be a good thing to chalk it up to. But yeah, I found it really odd. I thought it made the whole situation so much worse.
Yeah, it just really did not feel like the right way to handle it.
I totally understand why you would not want to come forward to the media about a cancer diagnosis. Particularly when she said, you know, I wanted to say at the beginning of the Easter holiday, so my kids aren't the centre of attention at school.
Yeah.
But the editing thing just was such a strange, like, side point.
I just feel so sorry for her and I feel so bad for the kids. Like, can you imagine being at the centre of this massive global kind of joke? When actually it's something so incredibly serious that's really going on behind the scenes. Surely the palace is going to have to take some learnings from this. As you say, new comms director will...
Well, no comms assistant, but they need a new comms director. Yeah. I mean, the whole team needs to be fired and rehired, I think.
Yes.
I mean, I was... the whole time, before I knew what the real reason was, I was just thinking, my God, they're like amateurs. Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And also, I'm sorry, but like... So the royal family actually has a history of digitally editing images. There was a whole piece, I think. I mean, I've seen many pieces where they're like, actually, like, this is common practice. Like, even the Meghan and Harry anniversary picture, they like photoshopped a tree behind them and things. Ah. So actually, it's not that unusual to edit pictures in the royal family. But come on, he's missing a fucking wrist or something, George.
Yeah, I saw an article that was saying that the royal family have a long history of manipulating images down to royal portraiture centuries ago.
But also you would think that maybe Kate would have at her disposal someone to like maybe do the photoshopping for
her. You really would. You think they have a top person on hand.
Or like anyone who was like releasing the image would look and be like, oh, that looks really weird.
Yeah.
George's hand is like completely deformed.
And so few bits of kind of official press come from the palace. You would think that every single one would have been like gone through with a fine tooth comb.
Yeah. So... I want to know, Kath, is what you think of celebrities who have made jokes about the Kate Middleton conspiracy theories and whether they should be forced to apologise. So, like, Kim Kardashian has not apologised.
What was Kim's joke?
So, Kim Kardashian posted a picture of her in front of a luxury car with the caption, "On my way to go find Kate."
Okay.
And she is under fire for not yet apologising.
It's very, very difficult because I... would not want to be a celebrity who'd made a joke about this right now.
No. Blake Lively made one, I think.
Yeah, but Blake Lively did some promo for her Betty Buzz brand, which we've talked about on air several times before. Hard seltzery alcohol soda drinks.
I'm personally over the hard seltzers.
Yeah.
Sorry, not relevant,
No,
guys.
No, but I think you're right. I mean, I don't even know if I've ever tried a hard seltzer and I already feel sick of them.
I just feel it's like people who are just scared to drink calories at festivals.
Well, it's just a like vodka fizzy drink, isn't it? So Kylie Jenner's whole hard seltzer brand that she just launched last week, Sprinter, they are just vodka with like fizzy fruit juice. I mean, what is that any different to any other canned cocktail? Do you want to try the black cherry one? Bet I would love that. Black cherry is a yummy flavour.
I mean, I actually think I did have a black cherry White Claw. But again, this was 3 years ago and I'm over it.
Yeah. Right, we want to give all of our fellow gym honeys a fabulous recommendation for a super healthy plant-based protein supplement that, unlike most of the other plant proteins out there, actually tastes bloody amazing, and we are obsessed.
We are. So I've been really interested in exploring protein full of actual nourishing ingredients this year, which is how I came across science-backed wellness brand Innermost, which focuses on making premium health supplements and is stocked everywhere from Ocado to John Lewis and Soho House.
Each of Innermost products are tailored to a specific goal, and we've both absolutely loved the health protein, which contains 31 grams of plant-based protein, which is actually much, much higher than most other plant protein brands, I'll have you know. Plus, lots of immune-boosting mushrooms, which, of course, I love, including shiitake, maitake, reishi, and cordyceps, and acai berries as a powerful antioxidant.
I am so fussy about how my protein tastes, so some of them can be really grainy and the taste can be really unpleasant, particularly with plant protein. But this one goes down such a treat. It comes in three simple flavours, chocolate, vanilla or strawberry. I have mine with oat milk and it is delish.
Each pouch lasts about a month and costs $29.95. You can see on Innermost's website all of the ingredients, and importantly, Innermost blends also have no additives or synthetic ingredients. They're low sugar, gluten-free. Essentially, it's all super natural, super gorgeous, just the way we like it.
Exactly. Go check them out, guys. Their whole range of products, including their protein powders, are at liveinnermost.com. Anyway, sorry, back to Kate. So my initial thought was, look, we were all finding the conspiracy theories quite funny when we didn't think there was anything more serious going on. Yeah. And maybe it was naive not to think there was something more serious going on. I'm not going to lie. I personally laughed when I saw like, oh, she's gone to have a BBL, or like, oh, she's growing out her bangs. You know, I thought that was just like harmless internet fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to say, to be honest, underneath it, I thought there must be something wrong, but I didn't think it would be something as health related. I thought maybe they're like divorcing or something.
See, I assumed it would be health related because of the abdominal surgery. That to me, it always seemed like, why is this even a huge Where's Wally?
Yeah,
like situation when they've said pretty clearly she's not been well.
So I think maybe I was blindsided by the fact that Charles had been so open with his health diagnosis. So I was like, clearly the palace like can be open with the royal's health. So why wouldn't they be as open as Charles had?
I suppose because kind of objectively and probably scientifically, I could well be wrong here, but I would very much assume that a man of his age getting cancer is quite different.
That's very true.
To someone of her age. And it is kind of undeniably more tragic,
yeah,
for a young mother of three to be diagnosed with such a serious illness than it is of a man in his late 70s.
I think maybe I also thought, look, she's had a major surgery, she's recovering on her own time, and she's just actually putting some boundaries in.
Yeah,
I just thought, I thought she would be back in June or whenever, after Easter. I thought she'd probably just, yeah, set some firm boundaries for once. And I thought, fair enough. I didn't really, I was shocked to hear that she has cancer. Really.
It's awful, and it's such a reminder of the kind of spotlight under which the royal family live, that they are literally not even entitled to privacy about the most serious private health matters.
What was particularly interesting was because the media was not allowed to report on the private nature of their health. I don't know what the exact like regulation is, but the media definitely weren't allowed to report on that. So they
can't speculate, basically.
Yes, exactly. They couldn't speculate, that's the word. And so for once it was like the internet that had like all the
narrative.
All the narrative. And it just did get me thinking about how the relationship between the monarchy and the media has changed
really
over
has.
The years. I think particularly working at a newspaper, I'm really aware of, you know, the very delicate relationship that newspapers have with the royals, because they don't want to piss them off too much because then they can get restrictions. I think the BBC, for instance, lost its exclusive production rights on the Queen's Christmas broadcast when it displeased the royal family in the 1990s.
Ew.
So the royal family can be quite like vindictive. Maybe vindictive is too strong a word, because maybe they're allowed to do this, but they can keep, you know, certain titles and journalists closer than others, and you can be in favour with them and out of favour. And everyone who works in the media knows that royal stories are huge. They do huge traffic. They sell papers. So like, you don't really want to be out in the cold when it comes to that media
That's
bubble.
That's such a good point. And it actually makes me think of two things. Firstly, I do remember at GQ, like, disparaging content on the royals was not allowed ever. Didn't matter the circumstances. We couldn't take that risk. Like you say, you do not want to have the royal family not on side, as it were, as a publication. But then on the flip side, I would also say, especially when you think about Harry and Meghan and how they so brilliantly detail the kind of inner workings of the monarchy and media relationship, in their documentary series. It's a very weird, like, scratch my back and I'll scratch yours situation. I would actually say that the Harry and Meghan documentary gave insight that showed the royal family is far more at the whims of the media than we would think. Actually, they're massively controlled by this weird relationship.
Yes, for instance, when Charles wanted to marry Camilla, they had to, well, it was reported, not proven, that the palace had to hire like a PR guru to rehabilitate Camilla's image.
Oh, because she was like a divorcee and all of that.
And I would probably assume that someone was hired to really help with her image in the run-up to her becoming queen as well. What I find not interesting, but spellbinding, is what right we have to complete access to the royal family. Mm. David Dimbleby, the broadcaster, told audiences at Henley Literary Festival that he felt that it was just really wrong, for instance, that the palace sought to control the every aspect of the televised funeral of the Queen. He said, "I think that's wrong. It's just wrong. It's really interesting how tightly controlled the monarchy is." Because they wanted to say that copyright of that funeral belongs to Buckingham Palace. But then I'm like, yeah, but if it's like
a public figure.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah. It's her funeral.
It's like their family member's funeral. Yeah. I'm really, really conflicted
on
this.
I'm torn. But then also, like, she consented to being queen and therefore a public figure, that, like, you are no longer an individual, really, with that kind of title. And on that note, kind of agreeing with David Dimbleby, I saw in an article from 2016 in The Guardian, Joan Smith, the executive director of Hacked Off, questioned the Cambridge's claims that the paparazzi were kind of being excessive in their kind of tailing of George. You remember everyone was obsessed with George and they were taking so many pictures of him. And Joan Smith argued that no other institution in the UK would be allowed to cow the media in this way. So I guess her sense, and maybe David Dimbleby's, is like, once you become an institution with that much power, you kind of have to waver your right to, like,
I really am torn on this, because
privacy.
It's kind of an evolution of the conversation everyone was having around Harry and Meghan, isn't it? Of, like, how much are you supposed to kind of give up in terms of your privacy, in terms of the public owning your narrative in exchange for this role, which I totally get is funded by the taxpayer. And so there's that whole element of, like, they do have almost jobs.
Yes.
And this kind of integration with the media is part of that.
It's really hard, isn't it? Because I feel so much empathy for Harry and Wills, as we talked about in our Harry Spesh. They were born into this family.
They didn't choose it. They didn't ask for this. Like, I feel really sorry for George having loads of pictures taken. I don't think he should be having his photo taken. He's a child.
Oh yeah, I agree. But I think maybe with adult royals, if you're deciding to still be working royals, because you can abdicate your title if you want. If you've decided to be a working royal, then I think you kind of have to accept that you have limited privacy.
It does speak to the particularly toxic nature of the tabloids in Britain, though, right? Because celebrities elsewhere in the world always find it pretty shocking that it's like the British paparazzi that they've got to almost be in bed with. You know, celebrities in other parts of the world get way more privacy. That's why lots of Brits even moved to LA. We have like a particularly toxic culture in terms of chasing people down, camping outside their houses, the actual kind of like misogynistic, problematic angle with which a lot of this coverage is often presented. Why should anyone have to put themselves up for that?
I personally think that the way a lot of papers have treated Harry and Meghan is no better than French Closer publishing the topless pictures of Kate Middleton. That's what I find really strange when the British media gets all like hoity-toity about like where the line is. Oh, so the line is you won't publish topless pictures of Kate Middleton, but you will be really racist and bully Meghan Markle.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, but I just feel like constant vitriol, written vitriol, day in, day out, is actually worse than a couple of like naked pap shots.
However, that said, when I was reading, when I was kind of preparing for this, I did go and have a look at those pictures again, because I was like, oh my God, I just actually cannot believe that they were published. I remember, so it was 2012 when the pictures were published, and I remember being shocked at the time, but I wasn't working in the media then. I'm even more shocked thinking about it now that I'm a journalist. It's interesting though to think that UK publications did receive the offer of the pictures and they all refused to publish them. There seemed to be this kind of etiquette, unspoken etiquette of British publications, though offered the pictures, will not publish them.
Well, there's also the spoken, right? Because with this symbiotic relationship between the royals and the press, there are certain things that they won't cover. So do you remember when, like, Prince William and Prince Harry were at uni, there were no photos of them because that was agreed that they wouldn't be taking photographs of them.
Yes.
Like, there's definitely agreements in place between the royal family and then lots of the tabloids about what is and isn't acceptable. And I do think it's classic Brit, like, hand-wringing as well to be so unbelievably abusive towards members of the royal family in the written words. But then when it comes to something as obvious as, like, nude pictures, oh, no, we could never. Which I obviously completely agree with, by the way, if they had publish those pictures of her, I think that would be completely disgusting and wrong.
It's kind of classic that it was a French magazine, right? So it's French Closer that published them. But yeah, to your point, actually, it's true. There have been some other kind of agreements between the media and the royal family in 2007 when Will's and Kate's relationship was intensifying. The then regulator, the Press Complaints Commission, circulated a letter to editors claiming that Middleton was being harassed, and it worked. The publisher of The Sun and News of the World announced it would no longer publish pap shots of Kate. So,
God, I really want to go back and watch the Meghan and Harry documentary now because it's just making me think of that. I feel like they did such a good job in that of kind of revealing just what this relationship really looks like.
And one last thing on those topless pictures of Kate, the then editor of French Closer, Laurence Piau, said that the couple were visible from the street and the images were not in the least shocking. Again, spoken like a true Frenchman.
Yeah, again, it's cultural though, right? Topless sunbathing is very much a thing in certain parts of the world. Yeah. You go to the beach and everyone's got their knockers out of all ages. You know, it's just not that deep, literally.
It should have been to so many nudist parts of the beach in France, because they actually have nudist sections and you often have to, you know, you have to step over. I've had to literally step over so many naked old people in France to get to my part of the beach.
Whereas we are known to be quite prudish as Brits, aren't we?
So. We are. And also it made me think of Tampon Gate, which I only found out by watching The Crown, when the transcript of a conversation over the phone between Prince Charles and Camilla was published by several British newspapers after it surfaced in an Australian magazine. And so, and again, this feels weird. Well, so they won't publish topless pictures of Kate, but they will publish a essentially like sex chat between Charles and Camilla. So Tampon Gate, guys, if you don't know, is that in 1989, they were on the phone to each other, having a private phone
call. Where did this transcript even come from?
So a radio enthusiast was scanning frequencies.
Oh, dear.
And also, can someone explain that? How does that mean that you get to access people's phones? I guess everything's transmitted
via... Maybe that's like an old school thing where phones used to work differently.
Yeah.
We'll leave that in the 90s.
So it was like every phone call on the airwaves. Is that like a really stupid conversation?
I have absolutely no idea.
Guys, can someone who has understanding of radios and frequencies and everything else let me know? Anyway, so he stumbled across this private phone call. I assume it's a man. But then sold it to an Australian magazine and then the British newspapers published it. But to be specific, Charles was suggesting that he wanted to be a tampon so he could always be inside Camilla. Sorry to be graphic, but I think you have to be. And they published that transcript.
I actually felt so unbelievably sorry for Charles when I heard that. I think it must have all come out the woodwork again, as you say, when the Crown was on, because I'd never heard about it before. And then suddenly there was loads of news coverage of that story like last summer. But I feel like that is so mortifying and so inappropriate. They definitely don't actually care about the kind of psychological well-being of the royal in question. I think it's all about the tabloids just looking like they have like a certain like modicum of decency. So they were like, nude pictures, that's too far. They knew that the public might not like it, that they'd get a backlash. I don't think it actually came from a place of decency and moral judgment. I think they just knew that they probably couldn't get away with that.
Yeah.
And they'd let French Closer do it instead.
Literally. I'm actually also still in shock that Charles said he wanted to be a tampon.
I know, don't. Is please. That like, it's really guys, vile. I feel like it's just,
Send us your worst chat-up lines. I think that must be one of the worst ever.
Yeah. Okay, this is a tangent, but I did actually read that Charles's openness about his own recent cancer diagnosis in part is what encouraged Kate to come forward with hers, and that they've had like a
great
real kind of
kinship.
Exactly that. I was going to say closeness. Yes, a kinship through this, because it was a similar situation where he'd been admitted to hospital for an unrelated condition and then cancer was discovered.
And I do think that, even though he's 75, it is unusual for a royal to talk about their prostate. I still think it's a bit of a taboo among men to talk about their prostate problems.
Yeah, it really is. I read a great piece by Rebecca Cope in British Vogue about how the royal family is breaking with tradition with Kate's announcement. She points to how, while Queen Elizabeth modernised the monarchy in many ways, transparency about her health actually wasn't one of the ways that she did that. So when Buckingham Palace did release short statements whenever the Queen or her husband, Prince Philip, were admitted to hospital during their later years, details were always scarce. And it was even only in a 2022 book, Elizabeth, An Intimate Portrait, which was a royal biography, that it was revealed that the Queen had been suffering from bone marrow cancer at the end of her life, which was a condition that reportedly caused her a lot of pain. And her death certificate to this day just says that she died of natural causes and namely old age, with no mention of that illness. So I think Elizabeth's approach was very much in keeping with the royal default as well, which was being stoic, dignified, silent, or, like, as the royals put it, to never complain, never explain. When her father, King George, died at 56, it was a shock to the whole nation, also to her even. He himself didn't even know that he had lung cancer. So his diagnosis was hidden from him by his doctors, who euphemistically referred to his left lung as having structural abnormalities rather than a carcinoma when they removed it.
Gosh, yes. I mean, I don't see why the Queen would have anything to lose revealing that, honestly. Like, it shocks me the extent to which they want to be private, but fair enough, you know.
Yeah, and I think Kate's decision does speak to this modernization, which is probably in part about social media and just the general kind of transparency with it, with which, like, everyone is pretty much expected to live their lives these days. The royal family moving in a direction that is more about openness and transparency. I think this step is in keeping with what I would expect from, like, the new generation.
I also wonder how much of a choice they have, because, like, someone was apparently accused of trying to hack her medical records.
Her private
records.
Medical records, yeah. Yes. Well, this is the thing. I wonder if she actually would have even announced it ever.
Exactly.
If it weren't for the fact that they're going to have such a level of intrusion that they can't physically keep it a secret without it becoming a circus.
I do think that now, because of all these amateur sleuths and the way people, I mean, the way the amateur sleuths were getting onto this via Twitter, I don't think you have a hope in hell of keeping anything private, honestly, at this point in time. I'm sure if Charles had kept it private, people would have found out what he was suffering from as well. And there's so many doctors doing their, like, green screens on TikTok being like, and this is what she must have. Even now they're trying to deduce what cancer she has. Everyone has an opinion on that.
Yeah, and loads of think pieces about what preventative chemotherapy is.
Exactly.
Even though that's actually a really, really normal treatment method.
Thinking just even now as we've been recording, I wonder if the level of hate and bile the British media have directed towards Harry and Meghan is because they feel like those are the royals that they're allowed to be really intrusive with, because they're not really allowed to with the other royals, because they know that if they were doing it with the other royals, they would have a lot of their liberties taken away from them.
Yeah, and they're kind of playing that game. They know now that they don't want to look like just general royal bashers.
Exactly.
So they've got to pick and choose.
And what's really disturbing is that the palace is kind of fine with that, clearly, and have allowed Harry and Meghan to be the royals that you are vile to.
Which, again, I keep going back to it, but that's what they basically say in their Netflix series.
Exactly.
And that's what was becoming very, very difficult when each couple hired their own separate communications person, where there was clearly an exchange of information going on, where they would literally try and sell negative stories about the other couple so they themselves could get favourable coverage.
Exactly. Which, by the way, guys, is what happens with politicians all the time also. I am really fascinated in these kind of, like, truces that the media will sometimes, like, establish with the royals, kind of informally. So I read that after Princess Diana died, there was a temporary truce between newspaper editors and the palace. They agreed not to use pap pictures and to end, air quotes, deplorable practices in their coverage of the royals. So again, that can't have been formal. I guess that was just like...
What does that even mean?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be quite interested to see how long their favourable coverage of all of the royals lasts at the moment. Everyone's treading very carefully, I think, and quite rightly.
Yeah. Of course, they couldn't help but get a dig in at Meghan, who's like, she has the audacity to launch her lifestyle brand whilst Kate is unwell.
Which, by the way, guys, we'll go into at length another time.
Yeah, we'll go into that. And
what's it called? Riviera Orchard.
American Riviera Orchard. I think that's too long a brand name, really. Bit of a mouthful.
It sounds like it's come from a spoof.
Yeah. I don't want to add to any Meghan hate, but I don't necessarily think that that sounds like a great brand.
Well, I'm going to wait and see what they sell. And I would also like to take this opportunity to say I'm still loving Suits and Meghan is excellent in it as Rachel.
I recently saw a screenshot of her in her underwear. Is that real? Does she have a sex scene in Suits? She must do.
She probably does. She's like a long-term character. Like, I'm still in the early seasons and she's in it from season one.
I remember my friends were watching that at uni and they would have, like, evening suit sessions and I just could not get into it.
Yeah, I feel like it would not have been my vibe at uni because I just generally wouldn't have wanted to watch anything so corporate.
Yes.
But actually, it's not quite as corporate as I perhaps... Well, actually, no, it is. You're still watching, like, people in suits, like, in big, tall, shiny buildings. Like, I think getting into Succession then gave me like the energy to be able to watch Suits.
If you would like a really superlative legal drama, Cathers.
Go on.
Better Call Saul.
Oh, I've seen that. Sorry.
Isn't it so good?
Didn't love it. Sorry. Yeah,
but after season three, I thought it was so boring. And then season three, I was like, this is a masterpiece. Onwards.
So I watched it straight after we watched Breaking Bad as like an offshoot, because I watched Breaking Bad late. Yeah. And so I think because Breaking Bad is so good, I found Better Call Saul a bit disappointing in comparison. However, I say that my dad, my sister, my stepmom, they love Better Call Saul. So
my parents loved Better Call Saul, but then couldn't watch the last season. I feel like everyone has a very unique response to Better Call Saul.
Okay, and before we move on, the final thing I'd like to say on Kate is to answer the question you asked me a good 30 minutes ago, I think, which was, do I think celebrities should be apologising? I think it depends on the context. I definitely don't think Kim K should be apologising for that kind of like off-the-cuff caption. I don't think that's like inherently disrespectful. Obviously, she wouldn't have posted that knowing. It was just tapping into the whole ridiculous internet sleuthing situation more than it is an actual serious weigh-in on where Kate actually is.
Yeah.
Speculation. However, with Blake Lively, a little bit tone deaf to try and launch like a new product from your business with it, you know?
And was it after we knew?
No, of course not. But she kind of tapped into the joke with the whole launch of like, everyone's wondering where I've been. And I mean, I'm going to butcher it now, classic.
But then again, is that, where has she been, Serena? Is that not also just Gossip Girl?
And who am I? That's a secret I'll never tell.
I kind of saw
XO, XO.
Isn't it also like a bit of a Gossip Girl reference?
To be honest, I'd have to look
she
it up.
She could have
and
styled
check.
It out, you know? If she didn't say that, I should be her crisis comms. Because
you could have sorted that with a couple of taps of the fingers.
Exactly.
God's sake. Guys, we are taking commissions for crisis comms management.
Do you think we'd be good?
I think we would be excellent.
Yes, I think I might accidentally say too much.
You'd be like, well, you fucked it, so you can just deal with this now. You're going to have to just hide. And my friend who is a PR does some crisis comm stuff, and she said it's quite difficult because often there'll be like this major thing happening that is like a fuck up on all kind of levels, but then they expect you to basically solve it as the crisis comms person. And you're like, no, we can put out a statement and we can damage control, but... And actually, it's like, well, whether it's, I don't know, an airline that's lost someone's dog, or whether it's some kind of platform that's meant to be about free speech, but has actually been co-opted by, right-wing Nazis or something. Well, I mean, what is a crisis comms team even going to do for you in that situation, you know? Els, what I really actually want to know is how you sleep at night.
What a chilling question, Cathers. But actually, I do sleep quite well. Thank you for asking. So long as I don't look at screens before bed, and so long as I have my earplugs, because I live on a main road, so the traffic is deafening all night.
And would it be wildly presumptuous of me, perchance, to assume that those earplugs are from our Huns at Flare Audio?
Well, no, funnily enough, they are, Cathers.
Okay, so guys, as we all know, maintaining good sleep health is vital for your overall well-being, and Flare Audio sleep earplugs are a game changer for light sleepers. They're tiny, unobtrusive, and designed with a super soft memory foam ball that molds to the shape of your ear. So, unlike most other earplugs, they never ever fall out.
They have countless five-star reviews from customers suffering with insomnia, ADHD, extreme sound sensitivities, and more. Plus, sleeps fit into any and all ear sizes. They come with replacement tips, and they start from just £4.95 at flareaudio.com.
A steal. So for more tips on sleep health, we also really recommend Natalie Pennicote-Collier's excellent book, Sleep Reset. Natalie is a clinical sleep therapist who was dubbed the insomnia expert by the Sunday Times. Trini Woodall's a fan. And she's a Flare partner. So because Natalie herself and her teenage children are neurodiverse, teaching young adults CBTI to help with their insomnia is a very personal mission of hers.
What a good mission. Also, what's good is her mantra, which is a good night's sleep actually starts each morning.
Thank you so much to Flare. And also, it really reminds me of that Johnny Depp GQ cover. Do you remember after the Amber Heard allegations were made public, people were pretty upset that he was on the cover. And one of the major plot points in the piece was that he'd hired this massive crisis comms team to deal with his like disintegrating image. They were a very, very well-known like multinational corporation. I think that celebrities do that kind of crisis comms management more than we think. So I know, for example, that you can have a crisis comms person come in and change your entire digital footprint in terms of your SEO. Mm. So they can publish loads of stuff about you that pushes all the negative content back four pages on Google. There are lots of ways, particularly using technology, you can almost sanitize someone's whole public persona. And it's definitely something that lots of celebs are making use of.
Yes. And actually, I notice that when I look at PR, like new PR websites, they often have crisis comms as one of their offerings. I'm seeing that more and more.
Yeah.
Like, I think maybe before they were like crisis comms specialists, whereas now it's like part of a...
An umbrella,
yeah.
Offering, totally.
I remember reading reviews of Shameless once. By the way, I love Shameless. Obviously, they are our kindred spirits.
Yeah, I love Shameless.
But I remember seeing some negative reviews once saying that they were clearly trying to get into crisis comms as in the industry because of the way that they would often say on their kind of scandal episodes where they would talk about celebrity missteps, how they should have handled the situation and often like being quite apologetic on behalf of the celebrity. And some listeners were like, you're not being like... honest enough around these celebs and it's quite clear that you're trying to like ingratiate yourself with publicists and become like into crisis comms.
No, that's just silly. Sorry, yeah. But you would not go podcast host turned crisis comms manager, would you?
I mean, particularly not after literally publishing a whole scandal series on an episode on a celebrity.
And I would also love to come in house and deal with your crisis comms if you'd have me.
In fact, you might have a crisis now that I've published 10 years worth of controversies to my million
special episodes on every misstep your client has ever made. So please do hire us. Yeah.
Actually, that's quite smart. Create the crisis,
then try and be hard.
Yeah.
Okay, honey. Well, there are two words that have been glaring at me from our very sparse notes this week, and they are the Lululemon cult. What the hell?
Sorry, like, yes. I've written that on the document with no
context. And I've wanted to ask context. You.
Right. Are you ready for a tale of leggings and murder?
I am very ready for a tale of leggings and murder.
Okay, so I have recently got into a very good podcast called Sounds Like a Cult. It's quite big in America, I think, but listen to it if you haven't yet. I'm currently on their cruise ships episode, but the other day I also listened to their Lululemon episode. So it's basically hosted by two Americans where they get into the everyday cults that we are kind of blindly war part of.
Love this.
Yeah, so Lululemon being one of them. And so there's two parts of the episode. The first part of the episode, they talk about why Lululemon is such a cult, and they talk about some of the practices in the Lululemon like head office, which are just mind-blowing. I will tell you about these first, and then we'll get into the
murder. Yes, because I'm like, why is Lululemon such a cult?
So I think, from the outset...
Their leggings are overpriced and not that great.
Yes. I have to say, I did wear a pair of Lululemon leggings after, and I think you had this too, we were offered, as part of our GQ perks, in lieu of an actual salary, to come to the Lululemon store on Oxford Street and just shop, just get whatever you wanted
to go into
for
the
free.
Flagship on Regent Street when it opened, and we got to go and choose an outfit. That was a fabulous perk.
That was wild.
Absolutely, not being ungrateful, Lululemon, if you're listening, please do invite me back for some shopping, because... While they are expensive, I will say they have lasted. My God, I must have got those leggings 7 years ago and I still wear them.
Yes.
So not all bad. Maybe that's some kind of reason that there's a cult.
Kathis, I think I'm actually wearing Lululemon leggings right now.
You're not. Wait. Stop it. Oh, they are. I can see the little thing on the leg.
Oh, my God.
Well, there we go.
I'm in a cult.
You're in a cult.
Guys, help me get out of this cult.
All right, so wind back. Why are we all in a Lululemon cult? Why?
Okay, so the podcast hosts believe that there is a toxic positivity with Lululemon that really taps into our obsession with wellness, of being the kind of person that like goes to Waitrose with a recyclable bag.
Okay, yeah, they are very much for like yoga moms, right? In New York, that's the vibe I've always got.
They were really like, the cult is mainly... white American women shopping at Target.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Trader Joe's or one of the ones that's...
Trader Joe's also a cult that I think is got its own episode on the...
Okay.
Everything is a cult. Be vigilant. So, so I think there is the whole like white middle class woman who thinks she's better than everyone else because she's got her Lululemon leggings on and she like is into recycling and she's goes to get like nice groceries and like takes care of herself and like gives to charity and I don't know, like whatever else. But also, I think the main cult is the people that work at Lululemon. So some of the details about what happens when you are inducted as an employee of Lululemon are wild.
Wasn't it also founded by a very strange man?
Yes.
And what's his name, Bob? Why is that
Chip
sticking out to
Wilson,
me? Okay, yeah.
Who then had to resign because he was so controversial.
A sex pervert.
And he kept saying that like the leggings were not for bigger women, basically.
Right.
He was like, our leggings are not for everyone.
Oh, my God.
He actually said recently...
I did know he was like kind of like that guy who founded Abercrombie. Yes. Deeply problematic in every possible way.
He's super anti-diversity and inclusion. And he actually recently said in a profile in Forbes that Lululemon are trying to become like The Gap, everything to everybody. And I think the definition of a brand is that you're not everything to everybody. You've got to be clear that you don't want certain customers coming in.
Oh my God. So he's very much not involved in Lululemon, I take it.
So, yeah, so he had to resign as a chairman in 2013 after he said that the leggings were not for everybody.
And he's still giving interviews 10 years later.
Yeah.
My God.
Well, I think he's very rich.
I can't get onto all of this now because we'll be here for very another rich. 3 hours. But I really want to know why the hell that man set up Lululemon in the first place.
Good question, Cathers. Maybe we'll come back to it. But back to the strange world of being inducted as a Lululemon employee. So they have an induction week where they have to do group yoga every day. They have to do afternoons of group folding, which I get is like essential to being working at a store. But the podcast hosts say that it's very much in line with this sense of strategic monotony to get them into a mindless state of subservience.
Do you know what's so weird?
What?
Is that my TV recommendation for this week, which is Netflix's new series, The Program, Cons, Cults and Kidnapping, which is about those very strange like military schools in America, taps into all of the mind control techniques that they actually used in these schools to
repetitive.
Brainwash people. And it was brain, and it was repetitive like hand movement stuff, like palms up, palms down, and all these really weird continuous movements that sound very much like that.
Like group folding. Even group yoga tends to be, you know.
Oh my God.
Guys. Wow. Okay, so they would then have to do required reading in the evening. They had to read self-help books and report on them.
What?
They had to create goal sheets that then were framed and put on the walls of Lululemon HQ. So like goal sheets as in of the next 10 years for the employees.
When you're literally just getting a job so that you can actually pay your bills and you're going to be standing behind the till in Lululemon.
What you're trying to do, I guess.
They want you to build a career at Lululemon.
Exactly. The cult leader, whoever Chip that Wilson. Is. Chip Wilson. But I guess now it's whoever it...
Who even know. Is? The shadowy force at the top.
I'm just imagining a pair of like nefarious leggings. Like with a mouth. But yes, so I guess if you imagine all your goals in tandem with Lululemon, then it's really hard to educate yourself. And they actually quote one employee, anonymous employee, who was so scared of leaving Lululemon because her entire community, all her social engagements, like they make every part of your life really tied to the company. So everyone goes out together, like on weekends, everyone hangs out in the evening. She was so scared of losing her whole community that she, despite leaving the company to work at a non-profit, she decided to work at Lululemon Saturdays and Sundays. So she was working at a non-profit Monday to Friday and then remained at Lululemon Saturday and Sunday just so she could keep her network. Anyway, so more about this induction. When the founder came to visit some employees, they had to perform a dance to Michael Jackson's The Way You Make Me Feel. So this was Chip Wilson. Chip Wilson was 4 hours late and they had to perform a dance. How weird. Like, I don't know if it was their suggestion or like
that
they had
so
to be forced to, but regardless.
Unbelievably strange.
When one employee's sister died, she was told off for not making time for group yoga. So yeah, so I think in terms of working at Lululemon, that is culty shit.
Yeah, that is bonkers. I've definitely heard just general musings and coverage of the fact that it's quite a problematic place to work. But
yes.
I didn't realise that they were
brainwashing their employees.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it goes without saying that they were being very exclusive when it comes to sizing and all that's that. So in 2020, they had to create a diversity inclusion network. They added inclusive sizing up to size 20. But even that was denounced as performative, which I'm sure it is. Anyway, now on to the murder, because this is the most fascinating thing. So the second half of the Sounds Like a Cult episode about Lululemon focused on this murder that happened in a Lululemon store in Maryland on March 11th, 2011. And they then like contextualize the murder in terms of the cult. So I'll get onto that later, but for now, I'll just quickly tell you what happened that night.
Yeah, please do.
So two employees of Lululemon were doing a close down shift, and as part of the shift they had to check each other's bags, which again is also quite fucking weird, right? I don't know, is that normal practice at retail stores? You have to check each other's bags to make sure you haven't stolen anything?
Surely not.
But that's what they had to do. And 30-year-old Jana Murray found a pair of Lululemon leggings in her 29-year-old co-worker Brittany Norwood's bag after this weird bag checking practice on their closed down shift.
Also, sorry, but can I just interject and say, if you're going to brainwash your employees to the point that they have to remain in the cult for the next decade, yet they would still want to nick a pair of leggings, I don't know, it feels very weird.
Yes, I assume as well, like, you have a clothing allowance, but...
Yeah, because surely they have to wear Lululemon in the store, so surely they get free... Oh, God, I don't know.
I know someone who worked at a similar brand and they got something like 30%, 40%
yes,
off.
Yes, I have known that. Yeah, you don't necessarily get all the clothes for free. You just get like a good discount.
But you still have to wear them.
Yeah.
So they left the store at 9:45 p.m. after Jaina caught Brittany stealing a pair of leggings. Later, 6 minutes later, Jaina calls a store manager to tell her about the leggings. So reported to her co-worker. Soon after, Brittany called Jaina and told her she'd accidentally left her purse in the store and she needed to come back and get it. So essentially, Brittany was trying to get Jaina back into the store. So at 10:05 p.m, they're both in the store again, and employees at a neighbouring Apple store heard a commotion. What had happened is that Brittany had crushed Jaina's skull and severed her spinal cord.
Oh my God.
The police found 331 injuries on her body from 5 different weapons, including a hammer, a knife, a merchandise peg, a rope and a box cutter. The next morning, manager Rachel Ertel walked into Lululemon and discovered the obviously like harrowing scene. She calls 911 and tells the dispatcher, there's 2 people in the back of my store. One person seems dead. The other person is breathing. The police arrive and Jaina is lying face down in a pool of her own blood, obviously having been like absolutely mutilated. But Brittany is bound up with zip ties in the shop's bathroom. Brittany says she's very shaken. Investigators free her and they listen to her tale of what happened that night, which obviously turns out to be the most elaborate lie. So Brittany pretended that 2 men had bound them both up and killed Jaina. And she goes on and tells this extremely long lie about how she's a victim. And eventually the investigator there are so many inconsistencies to her story, and he calls her out and it goes to trial and the jury find her guilty, and she's currently serving life in prison for first degree murder.
My goodness.
But it was really interesting to hear about these 2 podcast hosts talk about why she would have committed that crime, because she comes from quite a wealthy family and there's no reason why she couldn't afford those leggings herself, they suggest.
Yeah, and also, even aside from the leggings, surely getting fired for nicking a pair of leggings is objectively less bad than going to jail for murder.
Exactly. But this is what the host of the podcast say, which I think is maybe a bit of a reach, but quite interesting in the idea of Lululemon as a cult. Like, it was so egregious to Brittany to be seen as no longer the it girl, i.e. the kind of girl that can no longer afford Lululemon leggings and would steal. She would much rather go to extreme lengths to hide the fact that she was no longer the like perfect Lululemon employee.
God.
And that like part of the cult had brainwashed her into thinking that like it would be better to go to such elaborate lengths, gruesome lengths, to hide the much smaller crime of just stealing a pair of leggings because she didn't want to be seen as a bad employee.
God.
I mean, I think that's maybe a reach. I feel like if you're going to make 331 injuries to a woman with 5 different weapons, that is probably torture rather than just murder.
Oh my God, I don't even know. I just keep saying, oh my God, because it's just so horrific. I was actually so not expecting where you were going to go with
this. No, I know. It's actually really awful. I'm so sorry, guys.
When was this? Sorry.
2011.
Right, okay.
The Lululemon store opened mere months after. It was only closed for like 3 months. So yeah, really dark. Clearly there was a crisis comms person brought in to help with the Lululemon there. Yeah.
Gosh, but just, I can't believe I hadn't heard that. Why that isn't some kind of Lululemon documentary?
I hadn't heard it either. I was totally in shock. Because the first half of the episode, I was like, yeah, this all makes sense. I imagine like Lululemon HQ being just like this. I mean, not quite as bad, but it didn't shock me too much. But then, yeah, when it veered into that, I was like, wow, to okay, kill for a pair of leggings.
I love the sound of this podcast. What's it called?
Sounds Like a Cult.
Sounds Like a Cult. Sorry, yes. Okay, I'm going to go away and dig into that.
Yeah, it's quite fun. And they interview people. So for the cruise ships one that I'm listening to right now, they interview someone who's worked on a cruise ship who feels like they've been part of it.
They can be quite culty.
Yeah.
I had a friend that worked on a cruise ship.
Really?
Yeah. And you do get those weird stories. There's lots of intrigue around them. I remember there being a big story a couple of years ago about an employee, I think on a Disney cruise.
Yes.
Who died, and her family were trying to get answers about why the hell she ended up overboard. And basically, because of the way that the cruise industry works as well, with the boats being registered in really random places, like to a random port in the Bahamas or whatever, there's no kind of proper legal recourse when things go wrong. So the families of people that have passed away or had things happen to them on these cruise ships in mysterious circumstances find it really difficult to just ever get any answers.
Disney, also a cult.
Yeah.
Adults.
Well, there's a whole thing, adults aren't allowed to like Disney. I like Disney.
Disney adults. But there's a really good Amelia Tate piece all about like the adult Disney complex.
Oh, I'm going to have to go and read that.
And like women who like cry when they get to hug whoever a Disney character is at Disneyland.
Yeah, that is slightly extreme, but each their own. If that's
if it brings you comfort and joy.
Hats off to you, honey.
Yeah. No judgment here.
Okay, so very quickly before we finish, the programme, as yes. I said, is spookily similar because it is literally about a kind of cult.
Funny how we both had cults on the brain.
Yeah, and we hadn't even talked about this. But yeah, so it's Netflix's latest true crime offering, and it's called The Programme: Cons, Cults and Kidnapping. And I have just found it really fascinating, particularly because of all the coverage we've done of Paris Hilton's experience with a disciplinary school. It gave you a lot more insight into the psychological workings of these kinds of institutions. I just can't believe, perhaps because we're British, any American honeys listening, let us know your thoughts on the whole like disciplinary school, military school, like,
pro or against.
Like, how kind of common is it? Is it something that's spoken about when people are younger? I would love to know. Guys, we've said this before, but when it comes to our podcast partners, they really are an authentic recommendation from us to you. We genuinely wouldn't tell you to buy anything that we wouldn't tell our IRL friends to, which is why we are over the moon to be partnering yet again with our favourite adaptogenic coffee brand, London Nootropics.
Yes, and of course, we are armed with a juicy 20% discount code again. So just enter straight up, all one word, no caps, at the checkout at londonnootropics.com. We'll also put it in the show notes. And if you needed just a teeny bit more persuading on how and why adaptogenic coffee will completely change your day, then listen up.
Okay, so adaptogens are fungi and natural plant extracts that clinical studies have proven to have incredible effects on our well-being, from reducing anxiety to boosting energy and your immune system. Els and I have been converts for about a year now. We are obsessed. We drink one or two of Nootropics' three adaptogenic coffee blends every day, depending on whether we're wanting to feel super focused at work, tackle stress, or just go and do some exercise.
Exactly. So I start most mornings with the Mojo blend before heading to the gym. It's made with cordyceps mushroom, known to increase aerobic capacity and oxygen flow. So it naturally boosts strength, physical endurance and ATP, which, fun fact, is our energy molecule. It's actually a way healthier pre-workout than your average pre-workout supplement, which contains way too much caffeine and sweetness.
God, yes, they make me feel so jittery. I do not like those. Nootropics, on the other hand, are top stuff, thanks to being so rich in active compounds, a marker of quality in adaptogens, by the way, all of which are listed on the Nootropics website, so you know exactly what you're putting in your body. I must say also that Mojo is perfect for anyone battling with a bit of jet lag.
So true. And if you're worried about adaptogens tasting a little funky, do not worry. These blends, all freshly packaged in gorgeous individual sachets, taste fab. So head to londonnootropics.com and enter the code straight up at the checkout for that 20% off. That's straight up, all one word, no caps. Enjoy, guys.
I've just never been able to wrap my head around why anyone would ever send their kids to a military school, right? And I think what this show does really brilliantly, so it's like a mini series and it's directed by Catherine Kubler, and she was a former student at one of these schools. And she says even then she was reading like The Count of Monte Cristo, thinking about, which is all about someone in confinement seeking revenge. Mm. And she planned her time seeking this revenge of making this big documentary when she was older to expose all this. You know, so this has been like 10 years in the making.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it's fascinating because it very much shows that it's actually the parents that are indoctrinated into the cult, not the kids.
Okay.
So actually, the program manipulates parents to a crazy degree in order to get them to keep their kids in these schools And it's they that are taking part in a lot of cult-like activity. The parents will have to go to these special meeting days where they all hold hands and do meditations. Oh my God. And ultimately, you can so clearly see it's all about money. Kids in school means they're being paid. So they will actively encourage the parents to ignore everything that their children say and not believe them. They'll be like, your kids are going to lie to you about what it's like here. You cannot be manipulated. They were trying like every trick in the book. They literally had a whole list, like pages and pages of prompts that were, if the parent says this, this is what you say back to them to make sure they keep their kid in the school. Like very, very coercive.
Sorry, my mouth just fell open, but I realised this is an audio form.
Yeah, super coercive. Shock. And they specifically look at this school called Ivy Ridge, but they show that this particular boarding school, therapeutic boarding school, I'm using air quotes here, was part of a much bigger network of different schools. There was one in Mexico called Casa by the Sea that actually got shut down because the conditions were so inhumane. It's absolutely wild to me that these schools were allowed to run. So Ivy Ridge was functional 2001 to 2009. How weird is this as well? People think they're culty. So the founder was this man called Robert Litchfield, who actually was like a cult leader. So he's the founder of WWASP, which is the company behind these so-called troubled teen schools like Ivy Ridge. And this is what the Netflix series focuses on. The parents were promised with all leaflets and everything that their kids would experience therapy, sports, education, with the aim of changing their behaviours and solving problems within the family. It would literally be like photographs of the kids horse riding and doing volleyball. However, the actual reality was that they were like really emotionally and physically abused. They had solitary confinement. They were treated like actual prisoners. One guy talks about how he went to prison after the troubled teen school, and prison was like a holiday camp compared to this school.
Oh my God.
So WASP. So it's the Worldwide Association of Speciality Programs and Schools. Okay. Interestingly enough, his first job in the industry was at Provo Canyon School as a dorm parent. Provo Canyon School is where Paris Hilton was.
Oh.
So it taps into the psychology of the people that work in these places as well and kind of explain why they're a hotbed for paedophiles and abusers, because these people want to go to work in these institutions where treating children like that is not only par for the course, it's actively encouraged. So the kids were told by all the people working in the school that their parents didn't care about them. They weren't interested. They didn't want to know. These kids have kind of been just such problems that now their parents were washing their hands of them. And yet actually the parents were definitely giving loads of shit about their children. They're going to all these meetings and stuff, all these like cult-like practices that are being set up by the WWASP to encourage them to keep their kids there, essentially to keep paying money.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. And the poor parents, I mean, I say poor parents, maybe they, like Catherine is very angry with her dad. So the director who I say whose entire, this entire documentary is particularly about her experience. She shows her fractured relationship with her dad, how angry she is at him, how they're trying to reunify. But the parents themselves almost need deprogramming. So there's one girl in it, and how crazy is this, right? Because they wanted the troubled teens to look so troubled, they would brainwash them using all these various methods and then have the kids tell actual lies about who they really were and where they'd come from. So making them look more troubled than they really were. So I don't know if I've explained that really badly, but as an example, one girl who was held up as this kind of bastion of change, like she was the role model, ideal Ivy Bridge student, had been a previous, like literal, I'm using air quotes here, crack whore, in her words. So she told this story about how prior to the school, she'd been on drugs and like sleeping with men for money for drugs and all of this, because when she'd been drug tested, when she first went into the school, it came back positive. Well, actually she'd never touched drugs in her life and they'd lied to her parents. Yeah, the test was positive. And to this day, even now she's a grown adult. She went through all sorts of abuse in the system. Her parents still don't believe. Like her parents are still brainwashed. Her parents still think that that drug test was actually positive because they've been so indoctrinated that even with all the evidence in front of them now, they're finding it impossible to compute.
God. God, I find the psychology of cults so fascinating. I often think about hypnotherapists and like Rogan hypnotherapists and the way that they have access to your mind and can control your mind if it works. The reason I'm thinking about that is because recently in the news, there was a male hypnotherapist who was found to be making a lot of money by hacking women's phones and then selling their nudes. Like it was quite a misleading headline because I thought at first he'd done it by like hypnotizing them and then getting them to send him nudes. But actually,
sorry, not funny. Yeah, just, yeah. So,
which is why I clicked on it. Actually, he's a hypnotherapist. And
who just so happened to be hacking their digital.
So, actual files. People, I guess it's like a revenge porn kind of thing, actual clients would say, I want the news of this specific woman. Can you get them for me? And he would get them and then sell them for...
To the clients.
Yeah, so he would get money from the client to get the nudes of these specific women. But I was like, but also, and I guess the article was also saying that because he's a hypnotherapist, he is like uniquely skilled in like manipulation and mind control. But I was also thinking that surely as a hypnotherapist, you could also get women to do like weird things for you, right? Am I reaching?
I personally, and you know I like a bit of woo-woo, yeah. So it's not to say that I'm a skeptic. I am a little bit apprehensive about how much hypnotherapy techniques would work in the moment. Like, of course, there are techniques and ways in which to control people's minds. I'm not saying that there aren't. But in terms of an actual, like, hypnotherapy session in the way that we imagine it, you're literally hypnotized. Mm. Just not so sure it's like that. And so I'm not sure you would be convinced to do something.
Yes, you're right. Like, because actually, having said that, I read a really interesting article in The Cut only the other day about someone who cured their fear of flying by hypnotherapy. And yeah, it's not like they like go into a trance.
Look into my eyes. Yeah. It's like, that's not it. I know someone that quit smoking through hypnotherapy, and it's more almost CBT based. It's behavioral changes.
Mantras and like repeating mantras and like affirmations.
Rather than what as children we imagine when we think of being hypnotized, you know?
Oh, no. Yeah, literally. I would quite like to be hypnotized.
In Jungle Book.
Oh, yes.
I'd love to be hypnotized. I'd be skeptical if anyone would be able to do it.
But hypnotized to what end?
True.
What would you gain from it? I would like to be hypnotized into...
Oh, I know. I'd like to be hypnotized into not doing my bloody split ends. So, guys, I don't even know if I've ever mentioned this on air before. It's actually an insecurity of mine and also something that I'm trying to work on. But I have a really bad habit of, like, picking my split ends, which even just sounds so gross to say.
I've actually done it more since being friends with you.
Yeah, so I got it from someone else. A girl at my school used to do it on the school bus, and I sat next to her. Yeah, and she was like, oh, it's really satisfying when you look at the ends of your hair to find split ones. And I started doing it, and then I've just done it for about 15 years since. And it was actually you, even at first. You sent me an article that was in Style because I used to think it was just an annoying foible. And I've since realized it's actually like a kind of OCD thing. Like, it's actually a mental health issue more than it is just like an annoying habit. Whereas my mum would be like, stop doing that, it's disgusting. And now I actually realize that it's like, well, it's tryptomania or something it's called. It has like, it's much more of a real thing than I gave it credit for. And so did anyone else, be fair. Like, I remember my teacher at school, it was in my report. They'd be like, if Kathleen spent more time listening than hair straightening, then she'd maybe blah, blah, blah. But everyone just thought it was just like a silly habit.
I remember you telling me about that man on the train.
Yes.
Who was like, you have a problem.
Yeah. So sorry, guys, context here. And it really freaked me out, like I say, because I just always thought it was a weird habit of mine, the same that someone might suck their thumb. And once I was sat on the train on the way home from work and I was doing it, looking at my ends of my hair, and this middle-aged man just leaned over to me. He obviously meant well, but he said, you've got OCD. I know what you're doing, right now. And I had headphones in as well. So he'd like, not like, you know, tap me and I'd had to take them out. And he was like, that's an OCD behavior. I know, because I used to do things like that all the time. Bless him. I think he was trying to be helpful, but actually really freaked me out and made me feel really bad.
Yes, I think you need to be told that in a professional context where you can then be given support. I don't think an out of the blue diagnosis from a randomer is legit.
No, exactly.
Apart from, though, then I often read of like a doctor who was watching a news presenter notice they had a strange bump on their neck and it saved their life.
And you actually hear amazing stories like that. But I have to say, what really did solidify it for me as being something that is actually not just a little quirk was in one of Salman Rushdie's books. You know, I love Salman Rushdie. Yeah. His allegory, his political allegory, Shame. There's a character who's like severely mentally unwell, and like one of her main symptoms is doing her split ends. And I was like, oh dear. Okay.
Well, funny enough, I just read an article by a woman who's got a book out called, I can't remember what it's called, but it's some, you know, play on words to do with pulling your hair out. And she's, what would you say?
Tryptomania, it's called, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And she has it. It's not just split ends. She used to, when she was anxious, pull hairs from the root, and she would love to dissect the root. So she would then like pull the hair away to then like get to the root and then like pick it out with her teeth. Oh. And she said that it would, again, repetitive movements and the way that like dulls the brain. She would do it so often that she would essentially hypnotize herself. She would fall into a trance, and even to the point where she said something like she could hear her bath flooding, she could hear part of her house flooding because she'd left the taps on, but she was unable to move because she had like
got halfway through a special hair.
Yeah, she was like 2 hours into like a 4 hour session where she just could not move. She just had to keep pulling the split ends.
I mean, it is definitely a coping mechanism. Yeah. That's what I realized. It's about taking yourself out of reality and not having to like be in the present moment and like going into your own world. That's what I realized. And I think like it's definitely, even though someone showed it to me, I'm like, and it also started like soon after my parents had got divorced and I was dealing with all of that. And like, you know, like I can now look back and be like, oh, that's blindingly obvious that it was a coping mechanism that I've just taken with me into adulthood. Because even now I always do it way more when I'm like hungover or something. If there's any kind of anxiety or if I'm trying to like not keep eye contact or, you know what I mean?
Yes, I've noticed that. You do it less than when you're at GQ. I remember noticing it a lot when I worked with you at GQ.
Yeah, and I hated doing it there because I'm like, this is so embarrassing, particularly in front of men. Like, you're fiddling with your hair all day. You look like a moron. Really didn't want to
also,
do it.
Also, because you go cross-eyed, as in not you, but I notice that if I'm doing it, I'm like cross-eyed.
Yeah, you look nuts when you're doing it. And so it's definitely not something ideally that I would like to do.
Oh, babe.
Saying all of this, I have actually got way better.
You've got way better.
Way better. Because I'm also aware that it's actually a problem. And also, I remember you sending me that style article was a game changer when I realised, oh my God, this is actually like a thing that I need to address like psychologically. Mm. Was also, do you know Sam and Billy Fares, those sisters that were on The Only Way Is Essex?
No, I don't.
And Sam Fares has been really open about the fact that she has tryptomania, but with eyelashes. So she pulls out her eyelashes.
Yes.
And it was only when she had a baby that she decided to really like do something about it. And also she was left with no eyelashes, so she kept having to wear falsies because she literally was removing her own natural eyelashes just out of sort of anxiety.
Bloody hell. I mean, yeah, I've never had anything quite to that degree, but when I notice that I will always pick my skin if I'm anxious, and I can get, not in a trance, but I can get really carried away.
Yeah, and that's what tryptomania kind of is as well. I think it's even as well as hair, it can be about pulling bits of skin.
Oh, I do it
all
around
your nails. Yeah. And all of these little like anxious.
Eyebrows. I've done my eyebrows before as well. I've noticed that sometimes I'll be doing it without thinking and I'll have pulled like maybe something like 20 hairs. I mean, I've got big eyebrows, so it's all good. They're still there. But yeah, I've pulled out quite a lot of my eyebrow hairs sometimes.
So that was a really random tangent that I didn't expect to go down. But if anyone else has any problems with picking their split ends, let me know. I'm happy to chat
really
about it.
I really need to take a picture of you right now because you have the two funniest little horns coming out of your head.
Little angel horns, my little angel. Baby hairs. Well, tying up my hair does help. Sounds obvious, but wearing my hair up means that I pick less.
Very good point. Except you never have your hair up, really.
No, but if I'm at home alone, like in the day, I would. I've got it up right now, like we're saying.
Got it up right now,
I mean, I couldn't pick it during the podcast because that would be ridiculous. I literally wouldn't be able to remember what I was saying. So
yeah, that's true. Yes, I very rarely see you with your hair up, actually. I think you look very nice with your hair up.
Kind, thank you. I don't, which is why I never wear it like that, but I appreciate the kindness.
You are welcome. Right, well, I wasn't expecting to talk about
my hair picking. Hair, we haven't actually talked about it in a while.
My eyebrow picking or anything.
So, sorry for that little slightly gross ending there, guys. Hopefully someone listening.
We don't pick our noses, however. That is a line we don't
cross. We've got that one going for us.
Like the Meiji and the royal family, we have an invisible line of decorum. Okay, I'm becoming unhinged.
Honeys, we love to hear from you, as we always say. Please, please do let us know anything you'd like us to talk about, anything great you might have watched or read. I haven't even had the bandwidth with my current jet lag situation to tell you a single thing about my holiday to Mexico, but I promise I will next week. And I will also talk about the books that I read, which were
exciting.
One of them was Kindly an Ellie Lend.
Yes.
So we will debrief Romantic Comedy by Curtis Sittenfield. If you haven't read it and you'd like to, read it by next week.
Is it going to be the 28th when we go live? Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yes.
Huns, watch Big Mood, because we will watch it. I mean, you don't know this yet, but we should, because it's, I think, Channel 4. It's all about like millennials, like 30 something millennials, like having chaotic lives.
Oh, and apparently it's like, sounds right up our street.
Apparently it's like and it's got a huge cast. It's got Nicola Coughlan, is that how we say her name, and Lydia West
From It's a Sin.
Lydia West from It's Sin, exactly, and Nicola Coughlan from Bridgerton and Derry Girls.
Fab. Well, I'll certainly be watching that, guys. Let's reconvene next week, shall we?
Yes, a little bit of homework for the Easter haul, if you celebrate Easter, which I don't.
Thank you for that fascinating point to end on.
Although my parents have gifted me an Aero egg.
Well, that sounds delicious. I've not had an Easter egg in quite a few years. Do you know what I'm going to do?
What?
This makes me sound so miserable and tragic, but me and Marlon literally discussed this already the other day, which was, we won't be buying each other an Easter egg. We will be going into Marks and Spencer's 3 days after Easter and buying one that we like the look of to eat on discount.
Because Easter eggs are very expensive.
They are. You can get it for near enough nothing after. I had some great bits after Christmas. Loads of like canapes. Had a Colin the Caterpillar Christmas edition. All really cheap because I just got them on like the 29th.
Blimey. So one perk of The Office recently was that the features team at The Telegraph were doing a roundup ahead of Easter of the best Easter eggs and the best simnel cakes.
Ooh.
And I have to say that I tried the most expensive Easter egg. I think it was from like Pierre Hermes or whatever it's called.
I thought you were going to say like Fortnum & Mason.
No, there was a Fortnum. And I didn't like it. I didn't like any of the expensive ones. I liked the cheap one.
I like cheap chocolate. I do.
Same. But the Simnel cake, I have to say I tried a very expensive Simnel cake, but with a marzipan in the middle.
Not for me, that either.
Oh, so good.
Well, guys, the jury's out. Let us know. Do you or do you not like Simnel cake?
It will be the
most pressing poll of the week.
No, it won't be the poll, but there will be a poll. So do scroll down on Spotify and vote.